This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Bill Dorman. We're a few days away from the weekend, and in Hong Kong, that means a few days away from another set of street protests. They've been going on in one form or another since March, and on a larger scale since June. The coverage you see on television and hear on radio is dramatic and increasingly violent. There are big picture questions. How does this end? How much will Chinese authorities tolerate? What can they do to resolve this? We caught up late yesterday on Skype with Mike Chinoy, who was CNN's Beijing bureau chief at the time of the Tiananmen Square crackdown. He's covered Greater China in one form or another since the 1970s. At CNN, I worked with him in Asia on stories from the Kobe earthquake to presidential elections in Taiwan. He talked about how the protests in Hong Kong are having an impact on the city that goes way beyond the pictures on television.
It's extraordinary. I mean, it's, as always, the pictures make it seem worse than it is, in the sense that you could be having protesters throw Molotov cocktails and being tear gassed and, you know, two blocks away, be quietly sipping a beer and, you know, be barely aware that it's happening. So, no, 4 months in and no one has been killed. So, you know, just keep a certain perspective. But all that being said, it's terrible to see the city just sort of spiraling downward. And it does really affect daily life. What subway stop is operating, what streets are blocked. And it's now part of the calculation of daily life. So it's just these little things that erode the sense of daily life, compounded by the fact that nobody has the slightest idea how this ends.
In some ways, it's hard not to make a comparison of Hong Kong to Beijing in the days before Tiananmen. Do you see any similarities there?
It's really different. The Tiananmen spring of protest was caused by a whole series of, you know, domestic issues in China, and also was the result of a kind of decade of political and social liberalization that was the hallmark of the 1980s in China, and that brought to the surface all of these internal tensions in Chinese society. The only real parallel that I would see is that the controversy over the extradition law in Hong Kong, this law that would allow people in Hong Kong to be extradited to mainland China, where nobody trusts a legal system that's run by the Chinese Communist Party, was the catalyst bringing to the surface many years of frustration and anger among many people in Hong Kong over the way the political and social and economic system here was operating. And what we've seen is a tremendous frustration and anger and resentment, both on this initially specific issue of the extradition law, but then broader complaints about how Hong Kong is governed and about economic inequality and so forth. So I guess the parallel, to the extent there is one, is simply that the protest movement brought to the surface deep-rooted frustrations within the population about the way things were going. But the specifics are obviously very, very different.
And in terms of daily life in Hong Kong, you mentioned, you know, disruption to the subway system, to transit. What is life like?
It's very strange. There are times of the day and places around Hong Kong where you would never have the slightest idea that anything is going on, but it is in the background. And what we've seen has been almost every weekend for 17 or 18 weeks, major clashes between protesters and police, demonstrations, the use of tear gas. But life sort of goes on anyway. And what you feel is that it just becomes part of your daily calculation now. You get up in the morning and you check which subway lines are running, how long mass transit is going to operate, whether there are any protests scheduled. What's happened recently, because the situation has deteriorated dramatically and become much more violent in the last week or two, has been that the subway service stops now at 8 o'clock at night. And this is a night city. This is a place where shops stay open late and restaurants stay open even later. And people are out on the streets at all hours. So it's very, very disruptive. And people just have to factor in, can you get around? My wife was going to meet a friend for lunch the other day, and it took quite a lot of calculating to figure out where they could meet that they could both get to, and how could they have their lunch and figure out how to get back before public transport stopped. So that's just the way it is here now.
And what is a potential or possible way out of this? What's an ending to this?
One of the reasons why I am so worried about the situation here is that, like many other people who are watching it closely, there is no clear-cut way out at the moment. You have a Hong Kong government that created this crisis to begin with its obtuse and thoughtless attempt to introduce this extradition law, which has been politically clueless and inept at every step of the way. This is a political problem, and it requires skillful politics by the government to try to bridge these divides and blunt public anger. But you have a government that is politically hopeless and seems to have no ideas about how to proceed, except to take steps to invoke emergency laws, which they've just done to make it illegal for anybody to wear a mask at a public protest. There's no sign of dialogue on the side of the government. The result has been that among the protesters, people are becoming more and more radicalized, and you now have a hardcore, it's very difficult to estimate the numbers, but significant numbers of people who really want to fight. And you see this now playing out on the streets. You get these protests where young people dressed in black with helmets and gas masks and body armor, carrying clubs and hammers and wrenches, are ready to engage in street fighting. They're ready to vandalize shops and businesses that they see as owned by companies that are linked to Beijing or whose bosses have spoken out against the protests, or their biggest target has been the subway system, the MTR, Mass Transit Railway, because it's government owned. And initially, that was the way people got to and from these demonstrations. And then after it was criticized by the state media in Beijing, the MTR started changing its when it operated certain services to make it more difficult for demonstrators to get around and easier for the police. And so the demonstrators now see the MTR as the enemy, and they have systematically attacked MTR stations. And one reason why mass transit has been so badly affected is that many of these stations have suffered real damage. And I watched the other day in a fancy shopping mall on top of an MTR station, people came in with hammers and crowbars and smashed up all the ticket machines. And there are instances where people have set fires at the entrances to the MTR. So there's clearly a hardcore people who are spoiling for a fight, and there's no obvious political initiative coming from the government, which has put the Hong Kong police in a terrible position, because the police have essentially become the major interface between the authorities in Hong Kong and the population, since the government is not engaged in any political way. And so that's further radicalized the population and further antagonized people and made people deeply resentful of the police, which is a profound shift in how people viewed the Hong Kong police. So there is no obvious political way out, and therefore I'm deeply concerned that this pattern of violence is going to continue and get worse.
you've seen the Beijing government in different guises over many decades now. How can this be playing in Beijing?
Beijing has got to be absolutely furious about what's happened in Hong Kong on many, many levels. First of all, they have to be furious at Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam, who created the whole crisis absolutely unnecessarily with her stupid decision to try and ram through this extradition law when it wasn't needed, and when, as far as I can tell, Beijing didn't ask her to do it. But now what we've seen over the last few months has been something that in China would have been suppressed violently as soon as it first began. You see people burning Chinese flags. You see people denouncing Chinese leader Xi Jinping. You see them attacking mainland Chinese or people who are have spoken out in support of the government or
all of this on international television, by the way.
Well, you not only on international television, and the Hong Kong TV networks are showing all of this live, so you can literally sit in your living room and just watch the city go up in flames day after day, night after night, weekend after weekend. So this has got to absolutely infuriate Beijing, and there's been tremendous speculation about what will China do. Will they send in the army? Will Hong Kong become Tiananmen Square 2? I covered Tiananmen Square 1, so it's something that I thought about as well. But Xi Jinping is really stuck here in the sense that he's damned if he does and he's damned if he doesn't. If he does order that kind of crackdown, it will be the end of Hong Kong as we know it. You'll see an exodus of international businesses. It will destroy all the things that make Hong Kong separate and unique and therefore valuable to China. Freedom of expression, an independent legal system, a safe place to do business. It would be a terrible stain on China's image and would elicit all kinds of international condemnation. And it would cause serious financial damage because Hong Kong remains a crucially important financial center, and it's mostly with Chinese money coming through here. The Hong Kong Stock Exchange is very important to China. So there are lots of ways in which cracking down would be very, very damaging to China. And it's not at all clear that it would work either, because just in terms, just purely operationally, Hong Kong is a much tougher nut to crack than Tiananmen Square was. Tiananmen Square was a large square in the center of a flat city in a capital city that the Chinese Communist Party had levers of social control in every street, in every neighborhood. Hong Kong is an urban jungle of 7.5 million people cramped into teeming high-rises who speak a different dialect, who are utterly antagonistic to mainland China. So simply bringing it under control would be a lot more difficult than it seems. On the other hand, if China lets this go, Hong Kong is going to become this kind of rallying point for resistance to Beijing and to the excesses of the Chinese Communist Party. It's already become that. You hear people talking about, you know, Hong Kong has now become the center of what I think is a growing sense around the world of unease or criticism or opposition to the way the Chinese Communist Party behaves. You're seeing pushback in the United States in terms of U.S.-China relations. You're seeing debates in many other countries about the wisdom of certain kinds of dealings with China. You see it in the debates about whether the Chinese telecom company Huawei should get permission to provide the 5G services for countries in the West. But Hong Kong is kind of at the sharp edge of that. So it's become the symbol of resistance to China. And of course, Beijing is most terrified that the idea of resistance will filter across the border into mainland China.
We're talking with Mike Chinoy. He's a Hong Kong-based non-resident fellow at the University of Southern California's U.S.-China Institute. He's covered Greater China for several decades. And Mike, how do you think this is all playing out in Taipei?
The government in Taiwan is watching this very, very closely. The whole concept of one country, two systems, which is the framework that was created for Hong Kong to return to Chinese sovereignty while maintaining its own Western-style economic, social system and lifestyle, was basically devised by late Chinese leader Deng Xiaoping to lure Taiwan to have some kind of rapprochement with mainland China. The fact that the trigger for these protests, the deeper trigger for the protests here, has been a growing unease that China wasn't honoring the promises in one country, two systems, and was seeking to erode Hong Kong's freedoms, is really at the center of what's driving what's happening here. And the way the Hong Kong government has responded and the way the Chinese government has responded, certainly in terms of its language and its support for getting tough and for the Hong Kong police and its denunciation of the protesters, I think is being seen in Taiwan as further proof that the idea of one country, two systems is a complete non-starter. Taiwan has presidential elections in January. My guess is that what has happened here is going to provide a big boost to the incumbent president, Tsai Ing-wen, whose party, the Democratic Progressive Party, is generally seen as more sympathetic to the idea of an independent Taiwan, and which is hated by Beijing. Because people sit in Taiwan and they look at Hong Kong and say, if we have one country, two systems, that's our fate as well. So it's generated a lot of unease, a lot of support and sympathy in Taiwan for the protesters, a lot of contact between some political activists here and people in Taiwan that didn't exist before. But it's serving as a very strong advertisement that one country, two systems, as we see it play out in Hong Kong, is not something that people in Taiwan, they don't want to go down that road.
And in terms of Hong Kong itself and the sympathies of the people there, you alluded earlier that the protesters seem to have the sympathy of the population generally. How is that now, and how do you see that playing out?
We've seen evidence on the streets. There was a demonstration earlier in the summer, which by all accounts, 2 million people, which is more than a quarter of Hong Kong's entire population, took to the streets. And there's no question that a lot more people who didn't go on the streets supported the demands for political change. But not everybody does. And one of the things that we have seen has been really profound rifts in the society here, divisions over the protest movement have split families, split couples. It's a little bit like in the U.S. where feelings about Donald Trump run so strong that they've destroyed friendships, that people don't talk to each other anymore. It's the same kind of thing here. And there's a sense that you're either with us or you're against us. And so you've got these really sharp cleavages in the society. My sense and opinion polls suggest this is that a significant majority of the people in Hong Kong certainly support the peaceful protest and certainly support the demands, first that the extradition law be withdrawn, which finally and grudgingly the government withdrew it, but also demands that the government authorize an independent investigation of behavior of the police, that the chief executive, Carrie Lam, stepped down, and that genuine democratic reforms, which were promised to Hong Kong under what's called the Basic Law, which is the document governing its return to Chinese sovereignty, actually be implemented. I think there's a lot of public support for that. But there's still really, really deep divisions. And one of the things that is worrying as the protesters have become more radical is that you've now seen episodes where People who have challenged the protesters have found themselves beaten bloody, threatened. There have been some very, very ugly incidents involving more extremist types on the protesters' side in physical confrontations with people who disagree with them. And earlier in the summer, we saw clashes where people antagonistic to the protesters wielding cleavers tried to attack some of the protesters. So this has created enormous rifts in Hong Kong society, and you just within the society, and then you add to that this tremendous ill will and antagonism between many Hong Kong people and the police force, and total lack of faith and confidence in the government. It's very hard to see how Hong Kong gets put back together again, even if the street protests stop, because the public faith in the institutions that make a society work has been so badly damaged, and I'm not sure how that can be fixed. So in the long term, beyond the immediate what happens every day on the streets situation, I think Hong Kong's future is very much at risk. Its image, it likes to market itself as Asia's world city, but its image as a place where companies can come and set up and do business and feel confident operating because the legal system works, that it's safe, the government is competent and efficient. It's a jumping off point to do business with China precisely because it's not like China. All of that is at risk. So there are very profound longer-term implications of this, and I don't see how Hong Kong goes back to what it was 6 months ago, regardless of how this plays out.
Mike Chinoy is a Hong Kong-based non-resident fellow at the University of Southern California's U.S.-China Institute and has covered Greater China for many decades. Mike, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaii Opera Theater. Desired by both, but her heart leaps for just one, Floria Tosca meets a tragic end in Puccini's Tosca, October 11th, 13th, and 15th at the Blaisdell, hawaiioperatheater.org.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Coming up on the next On Point, the NBA, a pro-Hong Kong tweet, and backlash from Beijing. It all raises questions about freedom of speech and the costs and compromises of doing business with China. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
This afternoon at 2, following the world.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we examine one of the rules of traditional Hawaiian law, the law of the splintered paddle. The concept was put into Hawaiian law by King Kamehameha I in 1797 and was ultimately inserted into Article 9, Section 10 of the state constitution. It says, "Let every elderly person, woman, and child lie by the roadside in safety." The law became an early model for human rights and peaceful assembly, and according to legend, came about during an interaction Kamehameha had with a fisherman. As the story goes, the king and his entourage were on a military expedition in Pune when they encountered a group of commoners. He gave chase to the men and in the process got his leg caught in a reef. As he struggled to free his foot, he received a blow to the back of the head, the force of which was so great that it caused the paddle to splinter. While the king could have had the man killed, he spared him. Years later, the man was brought to him again, and rather than blaming the fisherman for his aggression, he praised him for having the conviction to protect his land and his family. Therefore, the law of the splintered paddle came to be. So for today's backyard quiz, what was the name of the man who struck Kamehameha with the fabled paddle? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. First one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Ruby Tuesday Hawaii, serving breakfast from 8 to 11 a.m. in Kapolei, Mililani, Moanalua Center, and Windward Mall. RubyTuesdayHawaii.com.
I'm Bert Lum. Today on Bite Marks Cafe, we'll talk to one of the primary organizers of the 2019 Hawaii Annual Code Challenge. We'll get a preview of some of the challenge pitches and tips on how to best form a team and how to build a prototype in 3 weeks. That's today at 6:30 p.m. on Bite Marks Cafe.
There are many challenges in Hawaii when it comes to climate change. Fortunately, there are also allies, sometimes in seemingly unlikely places. That's the case with our beaches and a biological byproduct of what's known by some as parrotfish and by others as the uhu. This is the topic of a piece today on Honolulu Civil Beat, and Civil Beat's politics and opinion editor Chad Blair is on the line with more. Good morning, Chad.
Good morning, Bill.
So it's not just the fish, but what they leave behind that's a focus.
Yeah, this is a Claire Caulfield story. It's terrific. I tell you, I learned something new every day from Civil Beat. Yes. You said parrotfish and uhu, right? The same thing. Well, Here's another way to think about them. The lawnmowers of the sea. And this is because the uhu, or the parrotfish, they have those big teeth, right? We've all seen them in the ocean. Well, something that I didn't think about until I read Claire's story is that what they do is they scrub seaweed from all the dead coral. That helps the corals regenerate and grow and, of course, allow for other fish populations to grow as well. But here's the catch. I did not know that what the fish then do, the uhu, their poop, their excrement actually is results in sand, very fine sand. And one single fish can generate 800 pounds of sand a year here in the islands. And of course, sand is very important given all of our troubles with erosion. And so, boy, talk about learning something new every day.
I was fascinated by this because it had never occurred to me. It makes sense when you step back. But then the downside of the story, though, is the threat that they're facing.
Right. And this is the whole point of the article, because it does go to climate change, because having our healthy reefs, they serve as barriers, help prevent storms and currents from eroding our beaches, and that's very important. But the fish are on the decline, the population of uhu, because they're very popular catches for local fishermen. This is particularly true on Oahu and the Big Island, and we are seeing significant drops in their populations because of overfishing. One of the people Claire talked to, a grad student at UH who actually runs a website about conserving uhu, says he describes it as bombing the reef. This is when scuba divers go out at night with their spear guns, and then they kill all the uhu in the area, and particularly when they're sleeping, because that's when the fish are so vulnerable.
You know, another point of education in this piece for me, too, was that spearfishing with scuba gear is illegal across much of the Pacific, and yet it is still legal in Hawaii.
Right. From much of Oceania, from American Samoa to Australia, you can't do that. It is allowed here. So what is being done about that? Well, there are some proposals. The Department of Land and Natural Resources, its aquatics division, they're looking at maybe having a night ban on fishing for uhu, but that hasn't happened yet. There's also talk about maybe considering the limit, a limit on the catch, right? A bag ban. As a matter of fact, Maui has something like that in place. They've had it for about 5 years. And if you're catching the uhu where you're not supposed to, there's going to be a fine. They can even seize your gear, your scuba gear, your spear gun. There's even no take zones. Like, don't go here. This is where you cannot take uhu. Could that be applied statewide? That is something that advocates for preserving uhu stock are pushing for.
And it seems like DLNR a bit cautious in terms of the idea of looking at this, but not rushing to any sort of judgment.
Right. Let's face it. Fishing is extremely popular here. It's an industry, and that's something you got to be careful about. You want to be able to strike a balance. But remember, these uhu are eating seaweed and invasive algae. They're allowing coral to thrive. They're protecting our beach from erosion. So maybe we ought to be more aware of the role that they play and, in fact, try and preserve these populations while balancing the needs of fishermen.
Civil Beats Politics and Opinion Editor Chad Blair with today's reality check about Claire Caulfield's story on protecting our reefs and beaches. Chad, thanks very much.
Anytime, Bill. Thank you.
And you can read that full story at civilbeat.org. Staying with that theme of climate change is going to have an impact on every one of our islands. And on this island, there's an example that's undergoing review right now that's sort of a case study, not only in the challenges of climate change, but also how to approach them. It's about flood control in some of the densest neighborhoods of Honolulu. HPR's Ryan Finnerty has been following the story and joins us more with now.
Hey, Bill.
Hey.
Yeah, this is the Alawai Flood Control Project. A lot of folks have probably heard about it. And as you mentioned, it sounds like, because of the name Alawai, that it's about specifically the Alawai Canal, but it's actually refers to the Alawai Watershed.
Much broader.
Yeah, much broader. It includes some of the most densely populated neighborhoods in Honolulu: Waikiki, Makaeli Mo'ili'ili, Palolo, Makiki, and Manoa Valleys. And it actually, the name Alawai refers to a geographic area in which any water that falls from rain or from a stream eventually drains into the Alawai Canal and the ocean in front of it. And so there are these watersheds all over the Hawaiian Islands. Some of them kind of conform with an Ahupua, and some of them are broader. And they're on all over the mainland, too, on different continents. Some of them are really big on the mainland because it's a huge continent. And here they can be a lot smaller. And they kind of follow mountain ridges and that sort of thing. And this project has been kicking around since the 1990s to create some kind of flood control protection for the Alawai watershed, because it does encompass some of these really densely populated and really economically productive areas of Honolulu. And in 2018, the federal government produced some funding to fund this project, to get it started. It was part of a series of flood remediation and flood protection projects from all over the country. This was just one of them. And it was managed by the Army Corps of Engineers, which is the federal agency. It's under the Department of the Army, but there are uniformed Army soldiers, but it's mostly civilian engineers. And they oversee the nation's waterways, locks,
and
rivers.
Tasked with also, you think of the New Orleans floods and the Army Corps of Engineers involved.
Yeah, levees, that kind of thing, canals. They've done those kind of projects for a long time, since the Jefferson administration, actually. Thomas Jefferson, that is. And so they were going to be designing this project, and it was designed to protect these areas from a major flood event, like the kind we saw in Hanalei in 2018. That was called a rain bomb. And it also hit East Honolulu, so the kind of the next watershed over, actually, from the Alawai one. And the Army Corps of Engineers projects that a flood like that, a rain event like that, in the Alawai watershed could cause over $1 billion worth of damage. Yeah, thousands of properties and businesses could be affected. And their modeling shows that the bottom of the bowl is what the project manager called it, is Mokuli Mo'ili'ili. So that's where most of the water would settle. For comparison, the Hanalei rain bomb dropped 50 inches of rain in a 24-hour period. That's so over 4 feet of water coming down, which was a new national record and remains a new national record, more than any hurricane or tropical storm. Just from that one event, $125 million in damage. And that type of storm is what this project is supposed to protect against. And we know that these storms are increasing in frequency and severity, in part due to climate change, but the damages are also worse because of human impacts on the land that prevent water from absorbing in naturally. And I talked about that with Josh Stanbro. He's the chief resiliency officer for the city and county of Honolulu, and that's a recently created office that oversees climate change adaptation.
The irony is this project came about because the entire watershed has been hardened. So whether it's driveways or streets or hardened streams, that water doesn't soak in any longer. 100-year storms may happen every year come 2050. We saw in Houston, there was 3 500-year storms in 18 months.
So you can hear there that there's sort of this two-pronged effect that human development has made rain events more damaging, and the rain events themselves are becoming stronger and more frequent. And that's kind of why policymakers feel like the time is now to act on this. But a lot of members of the community are not really happy with the plan that was produced by the Corps of Engineers. They want to build several detention basins. The exact location is kind of in flux right now. Originally, they were going to be in Palolo and Makiki that would collect this rainwater. So not necessarily dams that are permanently holding back water, but when a big rain event comes, they would slow down the flow of water so that it could be kind of dispersed at a lower rate and not cause damage. But the people who live in those areas weren't very enthusiastic about having these basins. They were worried of, you know, what could go wrong if they weren't maintained, that it could make a flood worse in that area. Also, there were some flood walls planned for the Alawai Canal itself that a lot of canoe paddlers didn't care for. And so this kind of general opposition to the design itself, not to the concept of flood protection, but the way that the Corps of Engineers wants to do it, is kind of being led by this group called Protect Our Alawai Watershed. Sydney Lynch, who's a Palolo resident, created it, and I went and spoke with her at her office in Kalihi just to kind of get a feel for what some of their concerns are.
I've lived on the stream for almost 25, 30 years, and you know, we see it when it's during the winter when there's a lot of water, and we see the area where it really doesn't really go above. And I understand that with the climate change and rain bombs, that if it rains, you know, very hard for a short period of time, or you know, that you could have a lot of water coming down. But again, like I said, in the last 25, 30 years, we've seen a bunch of water come down. So when they started saying that this massive structure needed to be built, it was just kind of like, why? Where are they getting the information? And you could have your big flood and then your basin could fail. Will this happen? No. But there is a possibility. And if you're living directly downstream from that, that's something that's really in your mind all the time. You feel so powerless because nobody's listening and they dismiss you as like a NIMBY. Well, I'm not a NIMBY, but I will be living with the effects of this.
So there are kind of two things she mentioned that are important. One is that there's sort of skepticism, I would say, about the actual need for the project. People wanted to know where the you know, the data is coming from. But then also they feel like they're not being listened to and their concerns are not being heard. And that comes into play because this local company, Oceanet, they're kind of a design and technology firm, was contracted by the city council to basically look at alternatives to what the Corps of Engineers put forward. Founded by Patrick Sullivan, he's a PhD in electrical engineering, and he champions this method of problem solving called design thinking that was created at Stanford University. And it's just basically a five-step process for how to approach a problem and solve it. And step one is actually empathize. And so Pat has been is starting to hold community meetings, and he said that step one for him is going to be listening, and he kind of heralds this as listening first before designing as a totally new way of approaching these projects that he says we'll need to do?
The way these projects get introduced and the way they get solved has to evolve like anything else. I was visiting the guys at the D School there at Stanford. What they're trying to do is introduce into the curriculum a degree on bringing complex projects to communities, because this is a problem we're going to be living with in the modern world. And it's not really addressed in traditional approaches of planning and architecture and that kind of thing. And I think as the communities have become denser, as things like social media, where communications are different, it is becoming more important to think about it and to put together a discipline on how to do this.
Sullivan actually told me that for that first meeting, the one I attended, he didn't even bring engineers. He just brought design thinkers, as he said, to basically there, rather than the traditional approach of here's an engineering problem, how can we solve it? They're going to kind of listen to the human side of things first and then produce a design that hopefully addresses a lot of those human concerns before producing a design and alleviate some of the tension.
And one of the key aspects of design thinking of taking into account the end user, sort of starting at the end and working backwards rather than projecting something that is pre-cooked.
Yeah, and that's sort of what he was clear to say. He doesn't think that the Army Corps of Engineers has any ill will or anything like that, but that they kind of took a more traditional design first and then present, and he's trying to flip that equation
a
little bit.
Different approach. Yeah. All right. Thanks, Ryan.
Sure thing.
HPR's Ryan Finnerty. You can read his story online at hawaiipublicradio.org. And tomorrow, look for a follow-up story from Ryan on applying design thinking to some complex projects with an eye to adapting to climate change.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Kilauea Lodge and Restaurant, a Big Island retreat in Volcano Village with a gift shop featuring island-crafted items. Gift certificates available for anniversary and birthday celebrations. KilaueaLodge.com.
Earlier in the program, we asked you to name a central figure in the origins of the Law of the Splintered Paddle. This is King Kamehameha during a military expedition. The law became a guiding principle of the Hawaiian Kingdom's judiciary system, as well as an early model for certain aspects of human rights. But the law was not a creation of Kamehameha himself, rather a reiteration of principles consistent with common Hawaiian rights and moral concepts that had already been upheld for generations. But the king put the concept into law. Today, it's part of the state constitution. It's also come up in discussions by homeless advocates and in the area of human rights. It might make more sense to attribute this law not to the king who enacted it, but the man who struck the king, inspiring the Law of the Splintered Paddle in the first place. His name, Kalele'iki. That's today's quiz, and we did not have a winner today. If you have a quiz, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. There's a grim anniversary of note this week in Honolulu. In 1928, Japanese-American Miles Fukunaga sentenced to hang for the killing of the 10-year-old son of a local banker. The case is the subject of a new book by Professor John Okamura at the University of Hawaii, and a story Noe Tanigawa has been covering this week.
Right, Bill. It's interesting because this is the first scholarly account of this crime that just tore the community apart here in Honolulu back in 28. And the author, Jonathan Okamura, professor of ethnic studies at UH Manoa, has spent over 30 years studying race and ethnicity in Hawaii and in the continental U.S. as well. Quickly, facts of the crime, maybe? All right. On September 18th, 1928, Miles Fukunaga, he was then 19 years old, kidnapped 10-year-old Gil Jamerson from a Punahou school classroom. He was dressed as a hospital orderly. Fukunaga said Jamerson's mother had been hurt in a car accident. He took the boy away in a taxi, and Fukunaga murdered the boy in Waikiki, hid the body, and sent a ransom note. The search for the killer turned Honolulu upside down for 4 days, and just as the National Guard was reporting for duty on this, Fukunaga was apprehended. On October 8th, 20 days after the crime, Fukunaga was sentenced to death by hanging. The speed of the proceedings is one aspect of the title of John Okamura's book. It's called Raced to Death in 1920s Hawaii. But Okamura says that underlying anti-Japanese discrimination colored almost every aspect of this trial. Vigilante mobs were calling for immediate execution, and Honolulu's Japanese community was really terrified at that point. While headlines were blazing about what they called the Kiawe killer, Fukunaga confessed. He said he always intended to confess. He just wanted the money to pay his parents' rent and trip back to Japan. Fukunaga had attempted suicide twice in the months before the kidnapping, but he was never given a standard psychiatric evaluation. The defense called no witnesses, and Fukunaga was convicted. There's a lot more about his appeal and reaction in the community. His grave is still there in the Mo'ili'ili Japanese graveyard there near the Kapiolani entrance to the H1 East.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, but why care about this now? Well, Okamura, an expert on race and ethnicity, paints this picture of 1920s Hawaii when the dominant socioeconomic group used its power to maintain the status quo. Okamura says in the 1970s, the gap between that top tier and everybody else has been growing and growing. And in the 90s, Japanese, whites, and Chinese Americans were together in that top tier. He is, however, saying that he has not seen collective mobility in other ethnic groups since that time. He's talking about Vietnamese, Samoans, recent Filipinos, Micronesians, groups who came after the plantations. Okamura says after World War II and statehood, Japanese and Chinese Americans just rose up as groups. And while there's individual mobility for Native Hawaiians, Filipinos, and others, but he says the numbers aren't enough to say it's economic mobility. And that's his point. Why? Our economy, Okamura says, is based on sales and service jobs, and it's just really hard for people to get ahead on that. And here it is. Okamura says that we must like it that way. I mean, that's his takeaway after seeing the opposition to the 2018 teachers' union proposal for that surcharge and investment property to fund education. Here's how Okamura sees it.
So with 70% of the public school students being from minority groups, the opposition to the passage of the constitutional amendment was also opposition to equal opportunity in Hawaii. The dominant groups are no longer in favor of providing opportunities to the subordinate groups like Filipinos, Hawaiians, Samoans, other minorities through public education that still remains the primary means for their socioeconomic advancement. Certainly you can understand the Chamber of Commerce not wanting to support the constitutional amendment, but the opposition came from four former Democratic Party governors. Members of the Democratic Party, our only newspaper, faculty union, we teach students from those groups. That opposition was so strong that, to me, it clearly went beyond whether or not public education is funded, but it was the desire to maintain the ethnic status quo, to keep Haoles, Japanese, Chinese Americans in power and control, keep the Hawaiians, Filipinos, Samoans, Micronesians, other minorities in their subordinate position.
No one would cop to that, John. No one would consciously think that and admit it.
Of course, they wouldn't admit it, especially if you're a Democrat. Like the affordable.
But do you really think that even in the back of their minds? No.
Well, this is the result.
It's the result, though.
Sure.
Yipes, Bill. I mean, you know, Okamura is kind of saying that power structures in society are working today the same way they did in 1928. You know, he's basically saying unless we consciously strive for fairness here in the system, the people in power are when they're making sense, it means keeping the status quo.
Well, and looking for where are the on-ramps to power, actually. And traditionally, that idea of education that is equally accessible to all, the public aspect of and the importance of that, and the access to quality education as a way up.
Right. I mean, you know, Okamura points out that this whole area of race and ethnicity is kind of squishy territory, but it can be measured, and commitment to public education is one of those ways.
Interesting that, you know, the phrase he keeps coming back to, and you highlighted it, is collective mobility.
Mm.
Because from time to time, you hear the individual stories and all of that, but that idea of collective mobility over time.
Forget to ask that, you know, forget to look at it as a whole. What Okamura points out is the question of, you know, how long will it be before there is another proposal to increase funding for public education? You know, how long will it be before we get another proposal like that?
Well, and it's interesting, too, because I know for a lot of critics of that particular proposal, there were issues with wording and with, aspects beyond the concept of it. But that concept of support for public education on the part of taxpayers and seeing that as an important societal good is something that he talks about.
I think a lot of people will support it, as you just said, but how exactly to do it? Nobody's been coming up with a whole bunch of ideas there.
room to grow.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. HPR's Noe Tanigawa. You can find her story about John Okamura's new book, Raced to Death in 1920s Hawaii, at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Dr. Carla Marie Manley, author of Joy from Fear. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about creating the life of your dreams by making fear your friend.
Sunday morning at 11.
That is the conversation for today. Tell us what you think, or you can suggest a story idea. Call our talkback line and leave us your comments, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find us on Facebook at The Conversation HPR, Twitter at HI Conversation. This program and all past ones are available on The Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Bill Dorman. Catherine Cruz is back tomorrow, when you can join us for more of The Conversation.